Today we have an immensely important subject, a topic concerning widespread human and environmental devastation, and a very expert person to address us on this topic. But before I introduce him, I should mention that the next forum in this series will be 3 weeks from today in this place at 4 o'clock on the question of models of applied ethics for dealing with public controversies, and it will be delivered by Professor Mark Leitzler. Concerning Professor Weigel, he was educated in Brazil, took his bachelor's at the Catholic University of Rio de Janeiro, and in 1977, did his master's in Rio also in 1984, and came to UBC after considerable industrial experience and took his PhD here in environmental geochemistry. And he's been a member of the faculty at UBC since 1997. And relative to his topic today, and we'll hear more about this later, he has been for some time a consultant to the United Nations Industrial Development Organization and is an expert on small-scale mining in the Global Mercury Project in Brazil, Indonesia, Laos, Sudan, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe. He is the author of 7 books and numerous papers. And relative to this topic, recently he co-authored with his colleague Baker, Protocols for Environmental and Health Assessment of Mercury Released by Artisanal and Small-Scale Gold Miners. More generally, and this is a comment I think that comes from one of his referees, a common thread in all of Dr. Weigel's work is research for the benefit of society, particularly the developing world. He has taken up the challenge presented by the need to integrate sustainable development principles into mining practice. He has championed the need to address the needs of local communities in close proximity to mining activity. His research has strong implications for engineering ethics. And here at UBC, in his role as professor, his goal is to produce mining engineers who apply ethical principles to the process of wealth creation. He teaches a graduate course on mining and society and undergraduate courses on mining, environment, and environmental technologies. His research includes sustainable development in mining, mining communities, and social issues related to mining, particularly this question of mercury pollution from gold mining, bioaccumulation and adverse health effects, and biogeochemical cycling of heavy metals. I think I've heard that one of the reasons for his huge success as a teacher is his wide versatility both in humor and music. Now, the topic today is tragic rather than humorous, but I think you'll see some intimation here about music, and perhaps we'll hear from him later in that respect. So we want to say, Professor Weigel, we tremendously appreciate your willingness to come and speak to us today on the environmental, ethical, and health implications of mercury used by artisanal gold miners.
Thank you, Phil. Thanks a lot. Well, it's an incredible introduction. I really enjoy it. Thank you very much. So Phil actually asked me to play some songs here because every Wednesday in my classes I play songs because the students are usually very sleepy, and then I try and just wake them up. And then he asked me to do the same here, so I have to do. But to do this, what I'm going to do is just sing a song that I learned in Venezuela when I was working there for United Nations. This is a song from the beginning of the last century, and it's talking about artisanal gold mining. And it's very interesting if you analyze that, because I work in El Callao. That's the area where these miners work. But it's very interesting because they call the miners bandido.
Ay, 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 bandido, estaba callado, estaba escondido, lavando su oro, muy cerca del río. Ay, 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 bandido, estaba callado, estaba escondido, lavando su oro, muy cerca del río. Un solitario minero que vivía en el Callao, ay, 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 bandido. Estaba callado, estaba escondido, lavando su oro muy cerca del río.
Thank you. Actually, this is a very wrong impression to think. A lot of people think that artisanal gold miners, they are rich. So you see here, according to the legend, that the guy is rich in Caracal. The Caracal is a nice place there in the interior of Venezuela. But actually, most of the miners, they are miners because they don't have another way to survive. I'm going to just start the talk here. We're giving a kind of a more general perspective of how this project is included into the UN Millennium Development Goals. And one of the things that I'm going to try to bring to this presentation here is that the main points that I highlighted in UN Development Goals in the meeting that I had in New York in September 2005. The points are that 6 million per year kids, they die from malnutrition before the age of fifth birthday. 6,000 people die per day of HIV/AIDS. 2 million people die from malaria each year. 800 million people are hungry every day, and 300 million are children. Tuberculosis infects someone every second. And someone with tuberculosis is going to infect 10 to 15 people every year. 2 billion 600 million people, 40% of the world population, do not have basic sanitation. 1 million people drink from unsafe water sources daily. 5 million people per year, mostly kids, they die of waterborne disease. So I don't know if you know this this book. This book was published in 1987, and they had another name, but it called Brooklyn Report. For the first time, this book just brought the idea of sustainable development. This was published with a lot of experts just get together, and then they come up with the conclusion that it's impossible to develop. So if you don't see the social and the environmental side as well. So, and the book highlights in the first pages that global food production is increasing. So it's not missing food on the earth. But at the same time, more people are getting hungry. So the gap between rich and poor is widening. And it's impossible to separate economic development from environmental issues. And this is the most revealing statement. Poverty is the major cause and effect of global environmental problems. Sometimes we think that this industrial development or industrial activities are the main environmental cause, the main cause of environmental problems, but it's not. It's poverty. So, in this space, I'm going to try to introduce what we call artisanal and small-scale mining, which is actually the theme of my talk here. So, we encompass all kind of miners, small, medium, informal, legal, illegal, everyone. I don't want to discuss the nature of the miner itself, but all the miners, the small and the big miners, doesn't matter, that use rudimentary process to extract minerals from secondary and primary ore. The implication of this definition is quite site-specific. That's a lot of countries, they just try to introduce this definition in their legislation, but they fail. So today, we believe that there are about 30 million artisanal small-scale mining guys mining more than 30 minerals in all virtually all developing countries. So typical minerals that they mine, gold, emerald, diamonds, ruby, tourmaline, topaz, all the things that we don't need, actually. So but it's pretty beautiful to see a woman with these things. China has the largest contingent of artisanal small-scale mining, depending how you define. So you have almost around 10 million people involved with that. So the impacts of artisanal mining are noticeable. So you can see abandoned and not reclaiming sites like this. So they mine and run away. Land degradation. If you fly over the Amazon, you see the impact of artisanal mining It's amazing. All the rivers diverted, and then they leave behind this destruction. Land invasion, that's the site I work close to Bolivia. I work in this place for 3 years. So this site was reserved site for to build a condominium. When they found gold there, the condominium never came up. So child labor, so it's getting very common thing that you have more and more kids involved, directly involved with artisanal mining. Armed people, so you have to protect yourself. I was working with these guys in as well. Every 5 minutes you have to just to say that you're here and the bandits do not approach you. It's a kind of a stress, I tell you. Poor people getting rich. That's another interesting thing. A lot of people in a society don't accept that the guy that's really poor and kind of very good at rich thing, and next day he's going to leave just beside you. So a lot of people, this doesn't come very easily. Gambling, it's very common. Drugs. Alcohol. Immense consumption of alcohol. Prostitution. And mercury pollution. So today I'm going to dedicate my talk on the mercury pollution, but we could have just talk about all the issues that I present here even deeply. So the artisanal mining range from very small panners, like this little boy in Laos, entire family of natives in the Amazon, and large mechanized operations, also in Amazon. So you see, a machine like this costs $1 million, and the guys bought a machine like this and operate completely illegally in the Amazon. So it's not a small peanuts, you know, just to invest $1 million in a machine like this. So when a panner finds gold, attracts a lot of miners. Because these guys, they go, when they find gold, it's impossible for them to be quiet. They go to the bar and start paying a lot of things. Like one day I was in a bar with some of these miners, and we are really late at night, and I said, well, where are you going to sleep? And he just crossed the street, was in the capital, and he bought an apartment for us just to sleep. And then 10 years later, I said, oh, remember that apartment that I bought? I said, oh, yeah, you did. Well, I never remember. I don't know where is this place. So this guy just spend gold, spend money like you don't believe. But more people join them. And they have something like this that they have in Brazil. So this is a hole. It's called Serra Pelada. Serra Pelada was a phenomenon that happened in 1980s, where 80,000 people were working in just one place. And it's very organized fashion. So this is at Serra Pelada in 1982. So 80,000 people working there. And they produce about 90 tons of gold from this hole. So Serra Pelada is back in the news now because this is flooded. And in the area, and now it was passed, the company passed Serra Pelada to the miners. And they're going to try to find a way to mine more gold there. So that's the version from the movie, from the Hollywood movie. It's called Run Down. So you see, can you see? I don't know if it, with the light you can see, but that's the movie where they are trying to show Serra Pelada how the guys used to work there. It's pretty much like this. I've been there a couple of times. It's a very interesting process. Extremely organized because they have a cooperative. So nothing was disorganized there. I guess one of the reasons because they didn't allow the woman to be there. Women are not accepted in that place. So one of the huge environmental impacts we have in artisanal mining is water siltation. So these guys, they use this hydraulic monitors, and very often this entire wall collapses. And just this was in the Globe and Mail another day there, because I was there with some students in Indonesia, and he was doing this. I saw the miners doing this, and the wall just came down and it killed a person. So another way to do it is they go down, they just dredge the bottom of the river, and then concentrate this in a sluice box. So more and more women and kids are being involved in artisanal mining. So that's a phenomenon that you see everywhere, especially doing the dirty amalgamation work. I just blame myself and many other people that work in this field for a long time, because we teach the miners, and the miners, they don't deliver this to women, and then put a woman to do the dirty work. So it's pretty bad. So today we have approximately 30% of the world artisanal miners are women. And in Latin America alone, we have 15 to 20%. In Africa, 30 to 40. In some of the places that I work in Sudan, is 90-95% women. In Asia, at 10 to 20. But in a place that we are working in Laos, for instance, that we have more than 90% women. So, and you see in the movie that are usually women, and they do the delicate work, which is the dirty work, is amalgamation. It's to deal with mercury. So, in the world today, we are talking about 9 million women directly involved in this activity, doing very heavy work. So, this is in Sudan. So, that woman there was 8 months pregnant and working this way. One of the things that are really critical, it's the women are working and they take the kids to the mines. So we are seeing more and more kids, you know, that are together with the mothers there in the mine. Well, in some respect, it's the only way to keep the family together, because they don't know where they're going to leave the kids. The gold price, I guess you guys are following, the gold price is increasing. It increases substantially. In the last 5 years, the price just jumped from $260 to $580 per ounce. So it's pretty good. So the more the gold goes up, the more people get involved. So as a fact that we have today, artisanal and small-scale mining increasing globally, especially in Asia and Africa. 10 to 15 million gold artisanal small-scale miners are working in at least 55 countries. I'm saying 55 countries, the countries that I know, and I have any news about that. But probably it's in much, much more than 55 countries. About 30% of the world gold is produced by artisanal miners. So a lot of people dispute this fact, because the official numbers, they represent just 30%. But the governments, they don't know how much the artisanal miners are producing, because the gold is not officially reported. So the miners, they produce gold, transform this in jewelry, and it's easy to leave the country. So a lot of the gold, I would say, the more than more than three times of the gold is smuggled. So 50%, this makes sense, because 50% of Africa lives with $1 a day, and a typical artisanal miner makes easily $3 a day. So it's an island of prosperity in a sea of poverty. So it's very, you can see in a rural area, when you have artisanal miners, they are in a better position than a farmer, for instance. So what I see today, this is the biggest gold rush that the world has ever seen. So people don't believe that, but I can see the things are getting out of control in terms of gold production by artisanal miners. And I believe that about 100 million people directly and indirectly involved in this activity. I'm talking about not just the miner, but the guy that provides fuel, the guy that provides transportation, carpets for concentration, food. So for each miner, you have about 10 other people working around and providing to this miner. It's a poverty alleviation, definitely. So you see in South Africa, when I tried to help this guy, there's a bunch of guys there mining, but I couldn't stand it because they didn't have water. They broke the sewage system in Johannesburg, and they're mining with the sewage. So I said that, well, mercury is not the main problem here. In terms of children involved, we have about 2 million people involved in artisanal small-scale mining. Actually, this is a number from Geneva International Labor Organization. So I'm talking about 2 million people directly involved. So accidents have killed more than 10,000 miners per year, in which 50% of these miners are in China. So you have a lot of accidents. These guys, they excavate holes that are shafts like this. They go as deep as 50, sometimes 60 meters, and then everything collapses and these guys are gone. So probably in the media you saw recently what happened in an accident in China where about 20 people died. So mercury, sorry, mercury is extensively used. I believe there are more than 100 tons of mercury is released by artisanal small-scale mining worldwide. This represents one-third of the global anthropogenic mercury emission. I'm going to give a kind of overview of how they use mercury and for you guys to understand the difference in environmental impact. One of the major problems we have, an environmental problem we have, is when they amalgamate the entire ore. Ore is the name, is a sophisticated name that I use in mining to designate an economic mineral. So when you have the material, the gold material or the ore, so they put an amalgam, they put a mercury in all the stuff. And I tried to amalgamate mercury, amalgamate the gold, using this kind of a magic property they think that the mercury has to go behind the gold and amalgamate gold. Actually, this causes a huge mercury loss and it causes a tremendous environmental problem because the mercury goes to the environment and it can be oxidized. When it's oxidized, it's methylated by a bacteria and forms one of the most toxic compounds. It's called methylmercury. And the methylmercury doesn't stay in the water, so it goes to the fish. Immediately, the fish grabs this compound. Is actually the sixth more toxic compound that we know. So another problem that we're going to show here too is when they burn the amalgam. They just use the mercury, and when they use the mercury, they have the amalgam, is the final alloy. And they have to decompose the alloy just to have the gold. And they just burn. They burn in the kitchens, they burn in everywhere. So, and then they have vapor entering the lungs and contaminate themselves. So that's the typical nonsense, that it just spread mercury into the sluice, and mercury goes with tailings. Actually, they learned this from North America, because in North America in the 1895, so a lot of miners used to do this, and the government actually promoted this kind of a method here. In British Columbia, I have a lot of archives where the government of British Columbia say, use more mercury because you're going to recover more gold. So, but you see the impact this in the Carson River in Nevada, where you have a super fund there. They try to fix the problem with the 6,000 tons of mercury spread in the river. And in California and Nevada alone, because of artisanal miners in two centuries ago, so you have more than 12,000 tons of mercury lost. In British Columbia, so the government was saying, was in archives of the government, they were saying the miners, they're using 13 kilos of mercury per day per sluice. This is just to make a calculation and put in perspective, this is 20,000 times more mercury than the artisanal miners use today. So you find a lot of polluted places here with mercury. So a method to amalgamate the entire ore that is very common is a copper amalgamation plate. So you just make a copper plate, they just put a mercury on the top of the copper, and then they pass the entire material through this copper plate. So what happens is this, when the material passes through the plate, the attrition just removes part of the mercury, and the mercury goes to the environment. So we are trying now with the United Nations to ban this kind of activity. It's pretty tough, but are we trying to say that this is not possible? So it's the kind of legislation they are working now. So that's in Venezuela, again, the copper plates. So when they finish this, all the mercury, all the gold that was captured by the mercury, so they just scratch the surface and they have the amalgam. That's the alloy, mercury and gold. So another nonsense is this method they're using in Indonesia. That's one of the reasons. They put mercury, look at this, they put one kilo of mercury inside of one of these ball mills and grind everything together. It's pretty difficult for us now to interfere in this here. First of all, because they have a shaman. His shaman is a religious guru. They're just blasting this mercury. And when they blast this mercury, so we cannot just tell the miners that this is completely nonsense. They say, well, I cannot do anything because this is blessed by the shaman. So blessed mercury I cannot touch. So it's a very complicated story we are facing now. So after this, they do this, another thing that is going on, the guys, they just use mercury and cyanide together. So now the cyanide is dissolving mercury and just going to the rivers. So it's just imagine the size of the mess. So this is actually a very common practice in China. So that's thousands and thousands, millions of guys there, probably about 10 million people, just using this kind of technique. China is the number one in mercury release from artisanal mining. Indonesia is the second. So when we concentrate the material and amalgamate the concentrate, so we can reduce the use of mercury. So that's what I try to do. Just say, well, concentrate first, so you're going to use less mercury. But unfortunately, when they concentrate, so the final tailings or the final waste, it still has some kind of mercury, but they discharge directly in the water streams. So typically, when they put a mercury in a concentrate, they have at the end that the mercury just go there and concentrate in all the minerals and it capture all the fine particles of gold. At the very end of the batea, the panning, they have a little amalgam. They have this kind of a mixture. But this amalgam has a kind of excess mercury. They have to squeeze off this excess mercury. And they have the amalgam. So very similar to the amalgam we have in the mouth. In the mouth, they have amalgam with 60% silver and tin and 40% mercury. So what they do to separate mercury from gold in the amalgam, they just burn. They just burn off this vapor of mercury, just intoxicate families, intoxicate everybody. So that's a movie from a BBC that I made in 1993. Look the amount of mercury these guys are using. And then at the very end comes the solid amalgam. Now the guy has to separate the amalgam from the excess mercury, and he just squeeze. Mercury is not very... You can have some kind of intoxication with the dermal contact, but it's not the main issue. The main issue is through the lungs. The main problem is through the lungs. Look, the size of the amalgam, pretty good as size. So they have probably about half kilo of amalgam there. So, and he couldn't find a better way to evade the mercury to do this with outside, see? This guy is extremely intoxicated because of this method. So now you see the mercury evaporates and leaves behind the yellow gold. So that's another example in Indonesia. They concentrate, put a mercury there, and now they're going to separate. You're going to see the amount of mercury is enormous for the little amalgam that he's going to recuperate. This water that you see here is the same water they use for drinking. They have fish there. They wash themselves there. So it's the same water. And then they separate the excess mercury, squeezing off the excess mercury, and leave it behind. So they actually lose this mercury that is being squeezed. And they can recuperate the mercury. So now you have the amalgam here, very small amount of amalgam, probably 3 grams of 4 grams of amalgam. And he couldn't find a better place to burn the amalgam than the kitchen. So he have he's cooking rice there and burning amalgam. And the people were eating around and then breathing mercury vapor. I looked for this guy the next time and he was dead. That was there. So, and the kids are just around there, and this is a tremendous impact on the kids. Okay, so the occupational exposure is pretty obvious when somebody's just burning mercury like this, or just breathing in all this vapor. Somebody breathing in vapor is going to have, the mercury is going to be oxidized in the lungs, is going to be accumulated in the kidneys. So, and then you can see these levels in urine, because the excretion of mercury takes about 10 days, so you can excrete most of the mercury through the urine. But a part of the mercury is not excreted, it goes to the blood, cross the blood brain barrier, and then it goes to the brain. So you can see here the normal levels of mercury of a person just burning mercury, and how much mercury they have in the urine. And very low in the blood, because the blood stays in the blood for a short time and it passes to the kidneys. So what are the typical symptoms of long-term mercury vapor poisoning? Is erratism, psychomotor problems, loss of memory, gingivitis. We call this Mad Hatter disease. Mad Hatter because in the Connecticut in the 19th century, all of the hatters, they use mercury nitrate to make the big hats. When they used that, they became contaminated and became crazy. So that's the reason that all of the matters in Connecticut were crazy. So you see this example, I don't know if you can see clearly here. So this is a miners with a high school education, so top guys, and then we asked the guys to make a little drawing like this, very simple, and they couldn't do it. So they lost completely the coordination. So the retorted gold, when they just burn the air, like you saw, it still has some mercury. And when they sell this in the cities, in towns, so the guys, they have to melt the gold to make the jewelry. When they do that, so this residual mercury is released. It's released in town. When it's released in town, so you see a person that is living above a jewelry, so breathing mercury for 8 years, became completely contaminated. So that's the person. So his neurological functions were completely impaired, so he is completely affected by the mercury vapor. Yeah, this is what happened in the process. So the metallic mercury is released by the artisanal miners, react with organic acids in the soil. And then this forms what they call soluble mercury complex. When the bacteria attack this soluble complex, form the most toxic compound, methylmercury. Methylmercury doesn't stay in the water and accumulates in the food web very fast. When it goes to the fish, 70 to 90% of the mercury is already methylated. So a woman eating this will not feel any symptom, because the methylmercury in a woman, if the woman is pregnant, just pass straight to the fetus. So that's what we call congenital Minamata disease. So you see now, a person living far away from mining and eating fish every day, they don't have high mercury in the urine, because mercury is not in a metallic state. Now it's in a methylmercury state, very toxic. So mercury now is accumulated in the blood, and it goes to the brain. So this was identified in the 50s by Minamata in Minamata Bay, when they tried to make use a mercury catalyst to make a plastic, and then a methylmercury was formed in a reaction and discharged in the ocean. So until August 97, we had about 10,000 victims, certified victims of Minamata disease, but we believe that the numbers are really larger than this. Congenital disease was known in 1972. Where pregnant woman eating fish, contaminated fish, passed the methylmercury to the fetus. So this is also a movie from BBC, from Minamata. I've been in Minamata 3 times, and it's a very dramatic situation. So this is Tomoko, but she was born blind and with the limbs completely, with atrophy in the limbs. So the fact of a Matthew Mercury, that her mother passed to her. Her mother was not affected. This is Mr. Kamura. I met his son. So when he entered the hospital, he stayed there for 3 weeks and he died. So the typical Minamata symptoms that we saw there is not very well known, recognized in mining sites. But our neurological problems, it's identified. You see kids with problems learning, you see a lot of neurological problems. So why the mercury is used? Because first, it's easy to be used, it's cheap, it's very accessible, and miners are not aware of the risk. That's pretty much that. Let's elaborate on that. Amalgamation is simple, very simple. It's much easier than, and it doesn't cost too much. The alternative is cyanidation, and cyanide is more expensive. You need more care, you need more investment to work with that. And cyanide is not easily bioaccumulated. You die, you don't die. So it's very black and white. So mercury is very easy to be used and form amalgam with most of metals except iron and platinum, and it's a very obsolete technology. The companies, they don't use amalgamation anymore. Mercury is cheap. See, you see the price of mercury just increasing from July 2004, and now in December 2005, because the price of gold just went up, the price of mercury just follow up. So still, with the price jumping from $5 to $15 in a mine site that they sell, so there are a lot of people making a lot of money with that, because in a mine site they sell for $100 a kilo of mercury. But compare with the price of gold, that is a $10,000 per kilo, so it's still cheap. It's very accessible. In most countries, it's not allowed to be used. Mercury, you cannot use mercury. But mercury enters the developing countries for dental use, usually. And in many sites, it's sold with dental use. I had a little piece here, but I forgot to bring. So it's very easy. You go to the mines, and you go to the pharmacy, you can buy mercury for dental use. I don't know how a pharmacy is selling mercury for anybody, you know, for dental use. But it's very easy to buy. I had a little vial there. So I guess that this amount of mercury for dental use that I export is for animal dental treatment. Doesn't make any sense. Where does mercury coming from? So usually mercury comes from developed countries. Developing countries, they don't produce mercury. So in 1999, so 96 tons came from Spain, from China to Indonesia alone. So Netherlands is the capital of mercury. So Netherlands export more mercury than any other European country. So in Zimbabwe, I asked one dealer, and he was importing 20 tons of mercury from Netherlands per year. So the Netherlands, we just found out that are exporting, actually in 2000, exported about 245 tons of mercury to 18 countries. Most of this mercury in Netherlands came from different sources, but one of the sources from North America. So Spain shipped about 774 tons of mercury. This mercury is mined. I mean, the mercury in Spain is mined in the mine of Almadén that exists for 5,000 years. UK export 200 tons of mercury, is the recycled mercury. So Germany, 105 tons. US, last year was 276. So, but I have a better numbers now. So, and since 99, Canada exported 218 tons of mercury to US. Most of this mercury is low quality. Is not good for electronic use. So when you export, by the way, when you export electronic mercury to Zimbabwe and they expect them to use for electronic and to make batteries, I think it's a kind of a cynical situation, because I don't believe they're going to use for to make special batteries. You know? The question is it illegal to export mercury? No, it's not illegal. Mercury is not considered illegal if you want to export. But every time that they export mercury, the reported use is not mining. It's dental, chlorine plants, batteries, and later on, they just sell in mines to be used in a gold extraction. So the question that we should ask is it ethical to export mercury? It's not illegal, because in the last conference we had in Slovenia, the mercury conference. So all of the mercury producers said, oh, we are not doing anything illegal. So definitely they're not doing legal. They're doing something that I don't believe that is pretty ethical. So let's see an example very close to us here at UBC. So UBC now recycles about 21,000 units of fluorescent lamps. These lamps, but all the lamps here, they have mercury. So the mercury can range from 20 to 300 milligrams per lamp. So, and they pay $16,000 for a company to come to UBC and to collect the lamps and recycle. I just went there and I visited the company. They just recycle, they just break the bulbs, they break the lamps, and just recycle the glass. And all the mercury there, they don't know how to recycle it, they send to U.S. So U.S. recycles and send to, well, I don't know where. Oh, probably no. So other source of mercury coming from Europe, it's the whitening creams. So a lot of miners, a lot of people, especially in the mining areas, use whitening creams to be white. So in Tanzania, probably 35% of the women, they use these creams to become white. So it's not allowed to be used to be sold in Europe. UK alone exports more than 50 tons of mercury in soaps and creams per year. So up to 6% of mercury is already in a very toxic form, is mercury chloride or mercury iodide. In Tanzania, more than 50 different brands of these creams that I found in a pharmacy there. So that's another example. It's very strange because we never seen people intoxicated with this mercury, but we just found an effect of whitening creams in the nose. So we see the guys getting white, whiter and whiter, but the nose is getting smaller and smaller. Look at this person here. Isn't that amazing? Look at this. No more nose. Isn't that amazing? It's mercury. Yeah. So what are the causes of poor mercury artisanal mining practices? Disorganization, transience, they're always moving, no technical assistance, no education, inadequate regulations, financial barriers, lack of support from the main streams of society, and hidden interest. That's a lot of people with different interests in this industry. What are the consequences of artisanal mining? Turbid water, so they lose the drinking water, loss of mercury products, mercury contaminated fish, malaria, and HIV/AIDS. In the area we're working in Zimbabwe, for instance, so we have 75% of the miners with HIV. So in Mwanza, 60%, and in Mozambique. That's the areas that I know. So mining and artisanal mining and AIDS, they come together because you have a little prosperity and the guy just started spending money. So you have a tremendous contingent of prostitutes in this area. So it's very sad. So what are we doing in a global mercury project? This project is starting in 2000, in the middle of 2002. So we are working in Brazil, Sudan, Tanzania, Zimbabwe, Laos, and Indonesia. We are also working in spin-off projects out of this. We are still working in Mozambique. We are working in Venezuela. We are working in Ecuador. And now we receive a request to work in Guinea and Senegal. So this project, it's started in Vienna. It was the base of UNIDO. And then when I came back to UBC, so the project was transferred to UBC. So we have here contingents about, so in total, we have about 30 people working in the project. So the specific goals of the GMP, the Global Mercury Project, are improve community health, reduce mercury exposure to miners and families, promote health-seeking behavior, improve community quality of life. So if you don't increase the income of the miners, they will not believe you. So you have to prove that you are there and you know more than them. You have to prove that something that you're telling them is going to increase their income. Otherwise, they don't listen to you. So if you try to explain that mercury is this, that, they don't listen to you. So you have to show that you're making more gold with less mercury. Now they're going to learn. So So far, what we did, the first phase was an environmental and health assessment, and we just saw the size of the complication, the problem. So we found out the problem was vapor, much more, was a much bigger problem than the methyl mercury. And now it's time for intervention. We are working now educating miners and community. So we are using high efficient gravity concentration, reduce mercury emission and exposure. So that's the steps we're doing. So miners cannot stop their activity to be educated. They don't care about education. So we have to go after the miners. Miners, they learn by examples. Miners must decide for themselves what is good or not. We have this kind of idea that what we know, it's better what they know. So it's very common when you go to a place that you have to do this, you have to use that. So they don't care about that. You have to leave with them to decide what is good for them. Miners move from one side to another. So what are we doing now? We're just making a transportable demonstration unit. So this is a tent. A tent is a circus. So a circus, what do we have? A technical trainer, and we have educational theater. We have a health, a nurse, audiovisual. So we're giving classes, and they have brochures that are going to show the guys. We give classes to the families, to the woman, to the kids. And at the same time, we have a bunch of equipment associated with that, where what we are talking here, we go there and produce more gold for them. So we're teaching them and showing how to do it. So what's the advantage is less expensive. The training go where the miners are. So demonstrate best practices and training. Platform for awareness campaign for miners. And provide education on health, not just on mercury, but we can just discuss about malaria, HIV, intoxication. We are just introducing some sanitation principles, so, and other things. So that's an example that we're just showing them that they have to concentrate gold instead of amalgamating the entire stuff. So how to use a carpet, how to use this great idea that is a concentrate gold in a magnetic sluice box. The magnetite is concentrated in the concentrate gold as well. So if they don't have money to do that, so we are just developing now recycled magnets so they can use concentrate magnetite, and magnetite concentrates gold. Very interesting. So there's an example where you're teaching the guys in Mozambique how to do this. So, and they concentrate pretty happy because they concentrate pretty fine gold. So also we are, instead of just using the hands to amalgamate, to squeeze off the mercury, so we came up with this sophisticated centrifuge that you can just make with two tubes of PVC and put a piece of fabric in the middle and then run the bicycle for a while and it can filter, and then you have less mercury in the amalgam than if you squeeze. So we are teaching them how to burn amalgam without intoxicating. Any solution is better than that, just to put it there and just to burn mercury and everybody watching. Yeah? So we are testing the breath of them, so we have a portable atomic absorption where I can just analyze how much mercury they have in the lungs. So someone in Vancouver, depending on how many amalgams you have, how many fillings you have in your mouth, you have a breath with 0.03 to 0.2 micrograms per cubic meters. So if I just bring my machine here, so that's what we have here. The guys on my side have 1 to 10 micrograms per cubic meter. It's pretty high mercury. So when we show this to them, they can see immediately the difference between me and them. So they convince, so we don't need to do the urine analysis. So we're going to show right away that these guys are intoxicated. So they see the results right away. So testing the breath. That's something very common. And the guys that just burn in Indonesia, they just burn mercury in the grocery stores. So another thing that we're doing is just a homemade retort with kitchen bowls. So we have solid bowls, so we're going to put an amalgam inside of a little cup, just put another bowl outside, seal with sand, and just cover it with a glass bowl, and burn it. So here we are teaching in Sudan how to do it. So just showing Sudan. And here in Ecuador, so we have the amalgam inside, and then the mercury evaporates and just condenses on the top, on the cover, on a glass cover. So it goes up, condenses, and it comes back in a sand. See? Very simple, and it costs almost nothing. So this is using Mozambique. So when they don't have retort, they're exposed to 50,000 micrograms cubic meter. So with a level like this, if they just breathe in immediately, they die immediately, no? So with a kitchen retort, a kitchen bowl retort, at a nose level, this decreases to 0.4 micrograms per cubic meter. Just to give an example, so the World Health Organization said that a level, maximum level, would be 25 micrograms per cubic meter. So this is the kitchen bowl in Zimbabwe. So this is Zimbabwe last week. So they developed a bellow with a plastic bag. These guys are very creative. They had this plastic bags, and they made a bellow out of that. So they increased the temperature of the fire, so it's burning very well. This is in Laos. So Laos, as the mercury is pretty expensive in Laos, so they carefully just clean the entire bowl with a cotton and recover the little mercury there. So this is in Indonesia. So after they condense this in the sand, so we are showing them how to recover the mercury, and they can reuse the mercury. Another thing we're doing is just to use water plumbing pipes to make retorts. That's so the mercury stays inside the retort, and then very simple, and then with air, the material condenses. This is a miner that was burning mercury in Kalimantan in Indonesia. So I just show him that the mercury that he was burning there. He has a very sophisticated process that this torch is a gasoline torch, but he just has a bellow, and the air passed through this little bottle with the gasoline and then increased the temperature. He was burning, and all the mercury is condensing around. He didn't listen to us. And then what we did, I talked to his wife, and I asked him about his sexual performance. And then the woman became really, really weird with that. But I was telling her, if he's not impotent, he's going to be impotent. And then the next day, the guy was using a retort. Well, if I talk about the kidneys, that I didn't know what are the kidneys. You know? So, but when I talk about impotence, I say, well, that's a case. Okay. Retort made of plumbing in Zimbabwe. That's another thing that we did in Mozambique and in Sudan. We just come up with a kerosene stove. So the material, the mercury is evaporated and then condensed in the water. So they can recover the mercury very easily. So more sophisticated retorts are made of local materials, but are also using solid bowls, $1 solid bowl, very easy to recover. So the awareness campaign strategy that we are using is just to impact the stakeholders, to create material to communicate the mercury hazard and the mineral processing techniques, promote health-seeking behaviors, use media, brochures, skits, celebrities. We are now trying to contact some celebrities to help us, so just to make some shows there in the TDUs, in the training areas. I'm trying just to contact some soccer players, Brazilians, of course. No, soccer players, not Colombians, no, not Brazilians. So, the brochures and poster we are preparing, the mercury hazard and solutions, why mercury is a hazard, and we are producing brochures about the maternal and the baby health related issues about the HIV. So some of the brochures, these are brochures in Brazil. So that's some of the brochures that I made in Indonesia. Of course, the language is not English, so we just translate to Bahasa. We translate this in Sudan for Arabic. So we have some events to attract miners and families. So we play some guitar there. We make some events to attract it. So this is so we train the trainers. The trainers became trained, and then they multiply the training effect. So what we are studying now in Zimbabwe, it's a street theater. This is in Brazil, but it's pretty much similar to this, what you're doing. But this theater is related to consumption of a community's consuming contaminated fish. So consuming big fish contaminated with mercury. So they're trying just to call attention to the public. They have to reduce the type, or just to change the type of fish they're eating. So I think in this case is a bit of exaggeration of the problem, because the guy is feeling the symptoms, is getting some tremors. But was very effective to attract attention, you know. So this is a bit of dangerous, because the public, they will not see a person eating fish with this kind of a symptom. But is an example. So our motto is education. So we are just providing a lot of education and more education. So I taught the Sudanese how to dress up. This is a part of the education. I taught my wife how to dress like Tanzanians. I taught my daughter how to dance samba like Brazilians. I taught my son how to make a kitchen retort like Indonesians. I taught the kids in many areas how to wear Brazilian soccer shirts. Actually, that's very interesting, because I didn't teach them. And actually, every time that I go to the field, we have the guys with the Brazilian t-shirts. And that's the amazing penetration we have, because I'm working in Sudan in the war zone, for instance, and every time I go there with a Brazilian t-shirt, oh, Brazilian, Brazilian, and then they always ask me to teach soccer, which for me is not a problem at all. So I taught the Venezuelans how to make extra money. I taught the Laotians how to work hard, and they learn quickly. That's amazing. In Laos, and these guys, you know, the women work hard, and the men stay all time, and they're just watching the ladies just to penning gold. The only thing they do is just to get two or three buckets per day of material and take to the woman, and they do the rest. I learned how to enjoy original hotels. It's a nice hotel in Suriname. Sophisticated restaurant like this one in Sudan. And for conclusion, I would say that artisanal mining is a poverty-driven activity, and artisanal small-scale mining can cause large environmental and social problems in developing countries. Many of these people became artisanal miners to escape social marginalization. Governments are not prepared to deal with the situation. They don't even acknowledge the fact that you have a lot of miners in the countries. Because the miners are not taxpayers, the miners are not the voters, so they don't care. So in many rural regions, artisanal gold mining is a much better opportunity for surviving than farming, and it's growing immensely. So today we have about 1,000 tons of mercury being emitted to the environment, and it's growing. So this represents more than 30% of the world emissions. Women have a key role in changing behavior in artisanal small-scale mining. So we are just approaching a lot of women and trying, because they can just make a difference, because they can just influence men and change their behavior. Mining companies and the government from developed countries must be proactive in helping these people. So we are trying just to convince people from the mining companies, just that they have influence in the areas we are working, just to help the guys. So we have some really good feedbacks recently. On June 24th of this year, last year, with the pressure of 28 NGOs and with our participation in the European community, so an agreement was signed by all European countries to ban mercury export by 2011. So Europe cannot export mercury by 2011. So until there, what are they going to do? Because they have a stockpile of 12,000 tons of mercury in it. So what are they going to do? They're going to just retire this mercury, or they're going to sell? So, and what happened in the U.S. and Canada? So we still have a lot of stockpiles. In the U.S. we have 5,000 tons of mercury there. And in Canada we are still recycling mercury. What are they going to do? So the next project, we are aiming to reach at least 30 countries in 5 or 6 years. So we're going to use the transporter demonstration units as a platform for most purpose. So, and then we try now to implement economic diversification. We try to show the miners that mining is not sustainable. They have to do something else. And they have to create roots to the land. They have to do something that they can stay there for a long time, not with mining. And finally, I would just leave you guys with this sad saying that I heard from a miner in Amazon, saying that it's easy for a man to become an artisanal miner than for an artisanal miner to become a man. Thank you.
I'm sure you have questions and comments you'd like to make, so Professor Weigel will be very willing to respond.
The comment, North America, the largest source of atmospheric mercury is coal combustion.
That's correct.
100 power plants put out 50 tons a year. You're talking 20 times the output from one source compared to 1,100 electric power plants, the biggest source in North America. That's a huge source of mercury.
Yeah. So if you compare with the cost to abate 1 kilo of mercury in North America, that costs about $10,000. So with $10,000, we could do much better abate a lot of mercury in developing countries, I would say.
Is there any way these people can ever in the future use, say, non-cyanide, say, thiourea process? Is there any way they can use a non-mercury, non-cyanide process for coal?
No, I don't see that. There are methods that I can use, for instance, that are, but when you have fine gold, I don't believe that they're going to use any other.
Is there any way you can have co-ops that can handle the mercury recycling?
Yes.
So that they don't end up doing individual processing. They get it on their, say, on their concentrate, and they don't just mess with individual.
This is what we did I've seen this in 95 in Venezuela. We are trying to do exactly this. So we call central amalgamation plants. So where the miners just concentrate and take the concentrates to be amalgamated or to be leached, if you can use thiourea or even cyanide, can leach it by some experts to do the work for them. And they can see what the guys are doing. I saw many cases. I saw about 5 or 6 centers in Venezuela working very well with that. So I think that's the way we're
that's
going.
A non-mercury system?
No, it's a mercury system.
But it's
controlled mercury system.
So they will accept that? It's
they will. It's more, I think it's easier for them to accept that. Because they accept mercury just making an alloy with gold. They don't accept that they have a very yellow concentrate. You put a cyanide there and the mercury is going to, and the gold is going to disappear. You have to prove them the gold is in solution, but they don't believe. So when you try to precipitate mercury out of the solution, they're going to say, oh, where is my mercury? Where is my gold? So in Indonesia now, that we are in a transition. That most of the Filipinos, the artisanal miners from Philippines, they just taught the guys in Indonesia how to use cyanidation. So they use cyanide. But the problem is that they didn't replace mercury with cyanide, using both, and it created an additional problem. So we just came from Indonesia and are trying just to tell them, look, if you use cyanide, go ahead and use cyanide. So it's much better to use cyanide than mercury. Much better. So they use cyanide. But at the same point, so if you just promote cyanidation, so you're going to put a lot of people, if you have 50 million people involved in this, so how many people can afford to have cyanidation? Big tanks, to pay for a reagent, to pay for activated carbon. So it's very complicated. I mean, the equity in this business is not very simple, except if they have a central facility. The central facility, they could just make cooperatives. So that's where Jim is working now. So they have a cooperative that can just take the concentrates and just operate by some specialist, whatever. So the governments, they are thinking about that. So, but I think this is a solution. That's a good solution. But it's very difficult to replace completely. And every time the U.S. Department of Interior, they try to work for 10 years, they work in Indonesia trying to replace mercury with cyanide. And then in the area they're working, I saw there the fish is extremely contaminated because they're using both mercury and cyanide.
I was a bit surprised, if I understood you correctly, about the fact that the miners seem unaware of the health consequences of their actions. Is that because they haven't been mining long? Or is it that they in fact are aware but are prepared to take the chances anyway, which would make your intervention a lot more difficult, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think both sides. They have some people that are really aware. And the guys that were aware, the most they do is this. So they're aware, but they think it is a simple problem to be solved. They're just putting a little piece of fabric in their face. That's okay. The other thing is that they don't see people dying with mercury, because most of the miners, they die with mercury with the kidney problems. And in the locations these guys are, so the health post cannot just diagnose that the guy died because of mercury. They say, well, you should go to a small town and say, how many people die with the kidney problems? You see, it's huge. But who is going to sign that they die because of mercury? They don't know. So that's an effect. They don't see people dying. If the people are not dying, probably this guy's from Vancouver. They're telling the stories for us. That is not quite true. So they underestimate the mercury poisoning. That's what I think. Some of the guys, they are aware. Some of them, they are not. Women, for instance, they are not aware at all. I saw a woman just burning mercury in front of the kids. In Laos, little kids. I saw many, many women just burning mercury at home. They're not aware. They never heard about mercury problems. So, but I would say today, probably 80% of the miners, they're aware the mercury is dangerous, but they don't believe how dangerous, they don't know how dangerous it is.
In Brazil, is the mine just occurred in the north, or does it occur in the country in the south as well?
It's pretty much in Amazon. So we have in Minas Gerais, in Bahia, now it's triggered everywhere. So in different states, where I just came from Brazil now, but in the state of Bahia, you have a lot of artisanal miners too, in the northeast. In the south of Brazil, there are some artisanal miners. But I would say that in entire Brazil, we have about 1 million artisanal miners, and I would say that more than 80% are in Amazon.
Could you tell us a little about the organizations that are cooperating in your campaign? Where you're finding cooperation and where you're finding resistance?
Yeah, that's a good question. So right now, we are working with the funds from the GEF, Global Environmental Facilities. So this is the World Bank and United Nations. So we are working based in Vancouver in IWC. So in spite of Canada is not part of is not a member of UNIDO. This is bringing a lot of headaches for us. So we are trying just to bring Canada back to UNIDO. They had some political problems in the past, and then that's another story. So we are trying just to bring back. But the most cooperation we're having now, it's with NGOs. Most of the NGOs, they're jumping into the project and helping a lot, putting more money and just spinning off and say, well, you guys are working here, why don't work in other country, just a neighbor country? So we have a lot of support from the NGOs. Some mining companies now are coming, but the mining companies, they just come to us when they have a conflict. Like today, I guess you guys saw in the news that Grasberg in Papua New Guinea. Grasberg is the third largest copper mine, was invaded by artisanal miners, and they have a conflict. Some people died. So I think that this kind of a conflict is gonna happen in many different places, because the price of gold is going up, and then a lot of companies retain some claims, nothing. So the miners are gonna start invading these areas. So we have a lot of cooperation from NGOs. Believe it or not, that I shouldn't say this too loud, but one of the main problems is cooperation from governments. So governments are now really keen to cooperate with this problem. So they accept, but they think that, well, it's not a big issue.
How effective would you expect this 2011 ban on mercury export to be?
That's a good question. Well, I think that this from Europe is going to be very very effective to stop trading internally. So So from one European country to another European country. I think from Europe to developing countries is going to be very difficult to control. Except that if they have some kind of legislation, that I just were trying to create a kind of convention to stop and to classify mercury as a hazard substance and stop the trading. But if they don't do this, I think it's going to be very difficult to control.
You said the People's Republic of China has a lot of mines. How would you stop People's Republic from buying up all the mercury and exploiting?
Yeah, that's one of the largest mercury producers in the world is China. China produces its own mercury, and they have another problem that we are facing now. It's called artisanal mercury miners, because they have a lot of mercury mines, and they produce their own mines. So the intoxication of the artisanal mercury miner is at least 1,000 times higher than a gold miner.
Can you control the exports to the World Trade Organization, or IMF?
I don't think so. So this is what we're trying, but I don't believe that we can do it. It's going to be very difficult to control that. But for China, for instance, that I think is going to be almost impossible. We're going to have the next conference in China, and we're trying just to raise awareness in China to do that. But I remember when I was working in China, this was about 80 years ago, and then I received a lot of delegation from China and said, well, what's the problem with artisanal mining and mercury in China? No, we don't have this problem. We don't have this problem at all. And then I had a lot of friends working with mercury there. No, it's not a problem at all. And then until one of my students went to China, and then he learned, he's a Canadian, and he learned how to speak Chinese, and he just entered in a bus, and I started asking people, you know, how about mercury, how about this? And then the Chinese guys in the bus became really surprised at how a Caucasian can speak Chinese. And then I said, oh, come with me. And he leave with the guys, with the miners there, you know, and in 3 years, he just found out everything about China. But until then, we had a lot of problems with the Chinese government, because they're trying just to hide this kind of information. And even now, that we had a lot of problems, because we have some colleagues there working in China and providing some numbers, but they said, don't quote me, don't say anything. So it's pretty sad.
Last question? If not, I think we'll thank you very much, Professor Breyer.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.